This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with returning guest attorney Andrew Seidel about his new book, American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. Andrew Seidel has been litigating constitutional cases like this for 10 years, very effectively, and his new book lays out a very scary scenario.
We'll also speak with renowned journalist, author, and documentary filmmaker John Pilger about his most recent article, The Coming War with China.
It's real and it's scary, and nobody that we know of lays it out better than John Pilger.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
America was not founded as a Christian nation. Church and state were separated. The founding fathers were mostly deists, not Christians. They did not believe in a personal, all-powerful God that knew everything and intervened in human affairs. They separated church and state because they understood from European history that bad and bloody results resulted when the government acted in the name of God. All this is changing in America now under the thumb of a right-wing activist politicized majority on our Supreme Court. They were put there by an extremely well-funded and well-organized conglomeration of ultra-right-wing figures. They have an agenda, and they're carrying it out. The newest Supreme Court Justice, Amy Comey Barrett, had a message for new lawyers. She said being a lawyer, quote, is but a means to an end, and that end is building the kingdom of God. This ascent in ultra-right wing can best be described as white Christian nationalists. These white Christian nationalists have won victories and they're on a roll. Taking away a woman's right to control her own body in the recent overturning of Roe v. Wade is just the latest example. They have stacked the federal courts, and particularly the Supreme Court, where they have a 6-3 majority. We speak today with returning guest Andrew Seidel about his new book, American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. Andrew Seidel is a constitutional attorney with more than a decade of experience in arguing about religion and law in front of the courts of the United States of America. He's the vice president at Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and he's a director at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Andrew Seidel is the author of The Founding Myth, the definitive book that demonstrates that America was not founded by Christians as a Christian country. His new book, American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom, is a brilliant effort. Attorney Andrew Seidel, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It is great to be back with you.
Andrew, the Supreme Court has been packed with the majority of ultra-right judges with a multi-pronged agenda. You write about one aspect of their agenda in your recent brilliant book, American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. Please talk about the various successes they've had so far in this respect. The most important one, of course, is the recent overthrow of Roe v. Wade. But I'm also thinking about the wedding cake case, the Christian football coach Kennedy case, the taxpayer funding of religious schools, and the funding by taxpayers of a 40-foot-high Christian cross on public land. Your thoughts on this, please.
Yeah, all those are fantastic examples, and all of them are highlighted in American Crusade. And what people really have to understand is that religious freedom is what protects everybody listening to this, right? It is what guarantees our right to be anything from an atheist to a devout Christian to a Hindu who believes in many gods to a pagan to somebody who is simply not religious. In other words, religious freedom has long been this shield. It's been this hallowed protection against government overreach, the minority's protection against the tyranny of the majority, and it's been guaranteed by a strong separation of church and state. But not anymore. And thanks to the packed Supreme Court that you mentioned, religious freedom is now a tool, a weapon of Christian privilege and Christian supremacy. And they are this. There's this powerful network of Christian nationalist organizations and judges out there. It's really a billion-dollar shadow network that have been working to weaponize religious freedom. And when I say that, I mean they are litigating in court the legal meaning of religious freedom as a constitutional right. And in the process, they are redefining it. They are perverting the meaning. And literally, the goal is to privilege the right kind of conservative Christian over everybody else. So the cases are superficially about these Christian crosses or veterans or about playgrounds and skinned knees or about private school vouchers or bakeries and website designers and gay weddings or coaches that just want to pray. But really, really, they are about privilege and supremacy. Again, literally about privileging the right, I'm using air quotes, I know nobody can see it, right kind of conservative Christian over everybody else. And we've seen since 2010 just a wave of victories for these crusaders. In 2011, the court allowed a voucher program to send taxpayer funds to religious schools. In 2012, it said that religious organizations can legally discriminate when hiring clergy, and then it weaponized that against employees who have no religious duties, again, in the name of religious freedom. It said that religious freedom can override the rights of other citizens in 2014. It upheld Christian-only prayers at the town of Greece in 2014. In 2017, the court forced taxpayers to fund a Lutheran children's ministry. And then in 2018, it rediscovered this potent argument, hostility toward religion, and use that to let a business owner violate civil rights acts and discriminate against protected classes of people. And that was the same year that after they bemoaned this hostility towards Christians that the court upheld the Muslim ban. And then in 2019, we saw that Christian cross that you mentioned. In 2020, it abandoned all pretense and said that taxpayers must fund religious schools. And then in 2021, using just this phalanx of legalism and jargon, it unanimously held that the Catholic Church can discriminate against a minority in the name of God while performing government functions with taxpayer funds. And then, as you mentioned, at the end of last term, the court just went off the rails. We saw it force the city of Boston to fly the Christian flag over City Hall, which is the same flag the insurrectionists carried onto the floor of the U.S. Senate on January 6th. It abolished reproductive freedom in an opinion that begins and ends with religion. It forced taxpayers to fund religious indoctrination at bigoted Christian schools, and it allowed a coach at a public school to impose his personal religion on other people's children. And we know that more cases are coming. And American Crusade tells the story of these cases, but also the overarching story in language that everybody can understand, the story of this crusade and how this once important right, this shield, is being turned into a weapon, and what you can do about it.
Yeah, they really are on a roll. Andrew, the former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote that, quote, "Those who would renegotiate the boundaries between church and state must therefore answer a difficult question. Why would we trade a system that has served us so well for one that has served others so poorly?" How would you respond to Justice O'Connor's question?
Well, I would agree with her. I'd say we shouldn't trade it. I opened American Crusade with that quote, and Professor and Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, who is sort of this scion of constitutional law. Like, he literally wrote the book from which I learned constitutional law back when I was in law school. He wrote the foreword to American Crusade, and he also included that quote. And I mean, it really is a crucial question, right? Separation of church and state is the bedrock of our democracy. Shielding our shared laws from religious influence and exploitation is what allows us to come together as equals, to come together across religious divides and build a stronger democracy. And as that wall is torn down, we see our democracy failing. And church-state separation is also the basis of equality and so many of the other things that people care about, progressive issues that they care about, from religious freedom to abortion rights to so many others. So I think O'Connor nailed this one. And I'll also just add that separation of church and state is one of the truly unique and original contributions of the American Constitution, not just to political thought, but to all humanity, right? We were the first nation in the history of the world that sought to protect its citizens to think and worship freely by separating church and state. And that's something we really ought to be defending and be proud of instead of trying to tear down and bury under myths of a Christian founding.
The Enlightenment figures that wrote the Constitution understood that. These people want to take us back 200 years. Andrew, what are the religious beliefs that these extremists want to impose on us?
I mean, they really want to impose their narrow version of Christianity on all of us. I mean, it really is. When you look at this attempt to weaponize religious freedom and see, try to figure out what they are actually trying to do here, the goal is to make it so that conservative, white, Christian men, heterosexual, cisgender men, are a special favored class under the law, that they are protected by the law but not bound by it, and that everybody else is bound by the law but not protected. That really is the end goal of what we are seeing with this, not just this push to weaponize religious freedom, but really with white Christian this wave of white Christian nationalism that groups like Americans United for Separation of Church and State are fighting so desperately against.
We're speaking with attorney Andrew Seidel about his new book, American Crusade. And Andrew, I don't want you to blush, but I just wanted to read what Catherine Stewart said about your book. Andrew Seidel shows how Christian nationalists have captured the courts, twisted legal doctrine, and are imposing a religious caste system on America under the false name of religious freedom. Seidel combines his extensive experience in First Amendment law with meticulous legal history to provide a ruthlessly honest account of this infuriating aspect of the crisis in American democracy. Brilliant and necessary. Well, that's what I would echo, because I read this book with great appreciation, Andrew. The Supreme Court is not an impartial arbiter. It is a political body. Chief Justice John Roberts was not being truthful when he said at his confirmation hearing that his job on the court was to merely call balls and strikes. The court actually does not do this. Let's follow the dollar, please. Talk about how the main fundraiser of this effort, Leonard Leo, has made the court into an ultra-right activist political body.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an important point. The conservative justices certainly on the Supreme Court are not impartial jurists that are just carefully working to determine the meaning of a constitutional provision without bias, right? You don't set out to pack the court with impartial justices. You set out to pack the court with ideologues. And Leonard Leo is universally recognized as the guy, the man who orchestrated the hostile takeover of our Supreme Court. So there's a former employee that I quote in American Crusade who described Leo's mission like this. Quote, he figured out 20 years ago that the conservatives had lost the culture war, abortion, gay rights, contraception. Conservatives didn't have a chance if public opinion prevailed, so they needed to stack the courts. Right, so that's Leo's mission, and that's what they did. And notice, I mean, this is just notice how anti-democratic that is, right? Notice the anti-democratic confession and goal inherent in that quote. If they didn't stack the court, the majority would rule. Democracy would work. Horror of horrors, right? And we know that overall, Leo's groups spent about $540 million. Well, that's what we know of. Like, so more than $500 million packing the court from 2014, which blocking Merrick Garland's hearing, up through 2020, right? Shotgunning Amy Coney Barrett onto the court. And you don't spend that kind of money. You don't spend $500 million because you want an impartial court, right? They bought a court. I quote another former colleague of Leo's who described Leo's job as, quote, the monitor of the nominee's ideological purity. And he's talking about judicial nominees there, right? The monitor of the nominee's ideological purity. And all told, we know that Leo is responsible for the confirmation of Roberts, Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. Thomas is an old friend. There's actually a video of the two of them joking on stage at a Federalist Society event in Texas about how Thomas is joking about how Leo is the third most powerful man in America. And all six of those justices are or were members of the Federalist Society. So that's six votes on the Supreme Court. And Leo personally chose five of them for their ideology, a crusader ideology. And let me just give you one example of that people may not realize. Let's talk about John Roberts for a second, right? The guy that people see as kind of maybe more centrist, maybe more moderate than some of the other conservatives, he is absolutely not. When Roberts once upon a time argued that public schools can impose religion on children at graduation ceremonies and that Christian Bible clubs can use public schools to organize, while he was in the Reagan White House, he supported a constitutional amendment that would allow public schools to impose Christian prayer on school children. In a legal memo, during that time, Roberts wrote this, quote, "We still have an uphill battle to return prayer to schools." We battle, return prayer to schools, right? That is the language of a crusader.
Yeah, it sure is. We're speaking about the book American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom, with its author, attorney Andrew L. Seidel. Andrew, let's talk about the Great Replacement Theory. Whites will be a minority in the USA by 2046. White Christian nationalists are reacting to the changing demographics. They made up a huge part of the insurrectionists on January 6th. How is religion being used as reaction to the fear of these white people, whom you identify as Christian nationalists, to their fear of this coming reality?
Yeah, this is such an important question because it really answers the why. Sauron and the Ring and Voldemort and the Elder Wand and Thanos and the Infinity Stones, Christian nationalists are seeking this weapon of power. But the question is why? Why are they so scared? And the answer to that is because of the changing demographics, partially, and secondly, because of equality realized, right? We know that nones, N-O-N-E-S, right, people who are not religious are on the rise. Americans are leaving religion behind. We elected our first black president and a black female vice president because of marriage equality, because every single day we are closer to the racial and gender and LGBTQ equality. And because white Christian nationalists are so used to seeing only a narrow world that reflects their straight, white, conservative Christian patriarchy, that the existence, let alone the equality of anyone else, feels like a threat to them. So the important tie here is that is why they are on this crusade. That is why Christian nationalists are seeking this weapon. It's largely a backlash against equality realized, right? Conservative white Christian American status as the dominant group in our society is threatened, right? They are losing the deference that they believe they are due. And when that happens, when a dominant group or caste in a society feels threatened or left behind by circumstances, it reacts or overreacts in a way to retain that status. That's why we're seeing them turn to Christian nationalism. That's why we're seeing them turn to violent insurrection on January 6th, to tearing down democratic norms, to these so-called strongmen. That's why they're seeking this weapon, equality. And I think it's really important to note to that parity is not oppression, right? And equality, even when it means the erosion of privilege, is not discrimination. We're not actually expanding rights or giving new rights. We are recognizing rights that have existed under the law but were never enforced. We're affirming the humanity of our brothers and sisters and siblings and admitting that we've been wrong. And as we come closer to realizing those aspirational values that are implicit in we the people and equal justice under law and these other founding maxims, as we recognize that humans are human and worthy of rights, conservative white Christian America is dying a slow demographic death, and it's rebelling. They are raging against the dying of their privilege, and so they declared war. And that war is this crusade that I detail in American Crusade, this quest to remake a shield, a protection, into a weapon for maintaining that once dominant group's status.
As a solution to the right-wing packing of the Supreme Court, you propose an expansion of that body. You suggest that Congress put more justices on the Supreme Court. A court of 13 judges would eliminate the majority they have now. Is this a realistic perspective given the current political climate?
Well, this was my suggestion at the end of American Crusade, and it was a possibility when the book dropped. And I what I feared was that we would lose the window of opportunity. That may have happened in the midterms. It's certainly possible that that window may have closed. But whatever political progressive solution you want to the things that you care about most in this world, none of those policies are possible. None of those solutions are going to stand with this Supreme Court. It is just not going to happen. Whatever it is that you care about, all roads lead back to One First Street in D.C. and to this court that has been packed and captured, right? So the fixing the court is a prerequisite to doing anything else. I mean, the court's not just turning abortion rights on its head, turning religious freedom on its head, and gutting voting rights and endangering our democracy. It's doing far more than that. Again, any issue that you care about. So the court requires a fix. So to me, the question is not whether this is possible. It's taking the time and effort to learn that this is the central question of our time. Like, if you want to do something about the threats to American democracy, the threats to the climate, to enshrine LGBTQ equality, a women's right to choose, you have to do something about the court first.
From my perspective, I believe that tearing down the wall is but one piece of an overall agenda. They want to roll back the New Deal with its progressive reforms. In the words of Trump's advisor, Steve Bannon, they want to, quote, eliminate the administrative state. Their agenda is to cripple administrative agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency or the Food and Drug Administration and clear the way for an aggressive, unregulated neoliberal capitalism. Do you share this view?
This is actually something I wrote about quite a bit in my first book, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American, especially in the later chapters where I talk about American verbiage and things like in God we trust and one nation under God and the other idioms that Christian nationalists use to argue that America was founded as a Christian nation. But, you know, neither of those are from the founding. They're from this earlier wave of Christian nationalism that crashed over the country in the 1950s. So, you know, in 1952, you get the National Day of Prayer. In 1953, you get the National Prayer Breakfast. In 54, you get In God We Trust on postage stamps. And you get Under God added to the pledge. In 55, the prayer room is built in the U.S. Capitol. In 56, you get In God We Trust adopted as the national motto, and then it's put on paper currency in 57. And the reason I point to that is because in the founding myth, and as Kevin Cruz also argues in his great book, One Nation Under God, that wave of Christian nationalism was forced onto the country by big business. So you have businesses and industrialists, including like DuPont and Firestone and U.S. Steel and many more, wanted to undermine New Deal regulations that they viewed as burdensome, and they wanted to erode the power of these newly influential labor unions. But their existing lobbying groups, like the National Association of Manufacturers, were so transparent that most Americans just ignored them, right? They understood them as extensions of the companies and dismissed them. So what the corporations and industrialists did was they turned to religious leaders and individuals and groups and to the religious messages that were more sophisticated and less transparent. So essentially, preachers and churches got into this game, and their messages couldn't be countered with logic because they were based on faith. And they claimed things that, like, freedoms are given by their God, and that, quote, Christianity and capitalism are inextricably intertwined, and that, quote, the New Dealers are the ones violating the Ten Commandments. And most familiarly, this is where we get the idea that this is one nation under God. And the high watermark for this religious messaging was the Religion and American Life campaign conducted by the Ad Council. And they ran 2,200 newspaper ads in 1949 and then increased those numbers every year so that by 1956, you've got 10,000 ads running, telling people to be Christian and to go to church. And by the way, the New Deal sucks. And of course, it worked. And the point that I'm trying to make here is that businesses and billionaires have deliberately exploited American churchgoers and more importantly, American Christians' faith for decades. This is a hallmark of Christian nationalism that we don't talk about it enough, but it's absolutely one that we're seeing being repeated today, right? Steve Bannon and Donald Trump are not what you would call devout men. They are cynical, exploitative, and willing to do anything for power, whether that's using Christian nationalism or weaponizing religious freedom to reward their Christian nationalist supporters. But this union between big business and conservative Christians and Christian nationalism in this country that we've seen for quite some time.
Andrew Seidel, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, but let me just ask you one last question because it's been in the news lately. It's not surprising that an organization as powerful as the Supreme Court would also be corrupt. The recent revelations about Clarence Thomas and his right-wing activist wife, Ginny, demonstrates that this is something that we really should be alarmed about. Also been revelations about Neil Gorsuch. What can be done about corruption and conflict of interest in our highest court?
Well, I mean, I think certainly we need a solution to this Supreme Court. We touched on this a little bit earlier, but I know people are very reluctant in this day and age that we treat the court like it's they are these oracles in their priestly garb handing these decisions based on the Constitution from down on high, and that is fundamentally not what they are. They are, as you pointed out earlier, a political body. They have lifetime appointments, and they are also one of the three branches of government. And when one of the branches of government gets out of control, which is what we're seeing happening here, not just with the corruption, but I mean, these justices are drunk on power right now, overturning precedent after precedent after precedent, longstanding, you know, 6, 7, 8 decades old precedent, some hundreds of years old, if you look at the COVID cases, right? They're just gutting these old cases, drunk on their power. And we have a system of checks and balances. This is what was designed. And when one branch of government gets out of control, it's up to the other two branches to check that branch. So if you care about the Supreme Court as an institution, you should be screaming from the rooftops that we need a solution to what is happening at the Supreme Court, whether it's ethics, binding ethics rules that can be enforced against the justices, or whether it's term limits, which I think are going to be more difficult, or my favorite solution, expanding the court by any number of justices. Let's not just go to 13. Why not make it 17 or 21 and limit the more justices you have, the less power each of them has on the bench, and the less value each seat has politically. So there are solutions out there, and what we need to do is convince our elected officials to act on them now.
Yeah, I'll say. Andrew, unfortunately, we've come to the end. I'm going to have to say goodbye. Again, congratulations on your excellent book, American Crusade. Please, before we say goodbye, tell people how they can get your book, American Crusade, and how people can stay in touch with your good work.
Well, American Crusade is available at fine bookstores everywhere. I always recommend bookshop.org because then you get to support your local bookstore while also having the convenience of shopping online. I am Andrew L. Seidel on all of the socials. I'm happy to answer follow-up questions people have on those. And I would love for folks to go support the organization that I work for that is fighting back against Christian nationalism, fighting back against the weaponization of religious freedom, and that is Americans United for Separation of Church and State, AU.org. We are fighting for freedom without favor and equality without exception every day.
Great work, Andrew. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
How does it feel when it's quiet and calm? And will I be denied? How will it feel when it's time to move on? Mother says, kneel and pray. When it gets hard, I will roll those sleeves. Life can be so. Well, where there'll be no one around. Oh, solid ground. Solid ground. Solid ground. Solid ground.
Today we speak with 83-year-old renowned journalist, author, and documentary filmmaker John Pilger from his home in Australia about his most recent article, The Coming War with China. Is China a threat? Is the fear that is being stirred up about China legitimate? China has the second largest economy in the world. It will soon be the first. In response to China's commercial threat, the United States has responded militarily by surrounding the Chinese industrial heartland with 400 bases in what has been called a noose. The U.S. has some 1,100 bases around the world, while China has six. President Obama initiated a multi-trillion-dollar vast nuclear buildup. This was coordinated with what he termed a, quote, pivot towards Asia. Most of the U.S. Navy now patrols the waters off of China. Tensions have been exacerbated with respect to who governs Taiwan. The U.S. government has shored up its military alliances with China's neighboring countries, such as South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, and Australia. And the U.S. is selling billions of dollars worth of nuclear submarines to Australia. We in the U.S. live in a country whose government has been in a perpetual war the last three quarters of a century, except with a brief interlude after its 20-year-old war in Vietnam ended in defeat. 3 million Vietnamese people died in that war. As a young reporter, John Pilger covered that war and understood that it was based on the lie that Lyndon Johnson told, falsely stating that the North Vietnamese had attacked an American ship in the Gulf of Tonkin. Another 1 million people died in the Iraq War. That war was based on the now well-known lie that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction that he was going to use against the U.S., and that he was responsible for the 9/11 attacks. A similar campaign of fear-mongering is going on now about China. The major news outlets parrot the government's fact-free line that China is our enemy. In his article, The Coming War with China, John Pilger wrote, quote, "A U.S. war against China beckons, and we have a responsibility to speak out. We know what is coming. Silence must be broken," end quote. John Pilger, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's very good to be on the program. Thank you, and looking forward to it very much.
Thank you. Well, in your recent article, The Coming War with China, you wrote with alarming passion about what is developing. Please tell us about this.
Well, I made a film about 4 or 5 years ago called that The Coming War on China. On China, by the way, because it's very much what is happening these days is provocation of China. The surrounding of the eastern seaboard of China with U.S. bases. And I investigated this and it went into a film. And I've since been writing about it since, because the whole geopolitical atmosphere dominated by the United States is about the potential of a war with China, which, when you think about it, is absurd. China is not our enemy. It's never been our enemy. It shows no sign of being our enemy. And yet, where the United States is building up its so-called allies for a war with China. Presumably, it will be a very provocative war with China. In other words, an invasion of some description. I find all this quite, although I've been to China and I've seen the bases and I've seen the evidence, but I find all this almost unreal, because there is, as I say, it's all unnecessary. But it's very much the main foreign policy thrust of the United States. Russia, I suppose, is number two, but certainly China is number one. And down here in Australia, which is an American vassal, they used to call it a 51st state, but it's, I don't think it really has that authority these days. It does what it's told. We have many U.S. bases, and the U.S. and Australia and the United Kingdom are about to conclude a big anti-China deal, which will involve nuclear submarines, and in other words, more provocation of a country that is our greatest trading partner. That's the strange irony in all of this. The greatest trading partner of many countries, because that's what basically China is interested in, is interested in trade, making things, and making money, ironically.
John Pilger, please talk about how fear-mongering was used to rally the American people's support for wars in Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Ukraine, and now China.
Fear-mongering. Yeah, but even that, you see, how could the United States be frightened of the world's poorest country, Afghanistan? I think it's worth asking these questions. The Vietnam thing was based again on China, that Vietnam would be one of the communist dominoes that would fall, said the propaganda at the time, allowing the great yellow peril of China to sweep down and take over Asia. Well, that's Asia. I mean, the United States is still a long way from Asia. The United States, I don't think it cares about whether the American population has been subjected to any fear-mongering. I think it just goes ahead, and it has since 1945, and takes over governments, attacks countries, destroys democracies, vulnerable democracies. It was doing that in Latin America for a very long time, and then after the Second World War, that policy became a world policy from the time of the Korean War on. The Vietnam War was part of that, and the fear was that communism would take over the world. Well, communism didn't take over the world, and many of the communist countries are no longer communist countries. So none of it makes sense, and I think that's very important, that in 2023, we're looking at something that should be seen from the perspective of today. And I said I used that word absurd because, seen from a distance, it is absurd. Many in the world, particularly in what used to be called the Third World, that is the Global South, whatever you wish to call it, are waking up to that. But all this is, in my lifetime, has been about the United States dominating world affairs. That's over. And that's what we're witnessing. It's not only over, it's over disastrously. They were driven out of Afghanistan, driven out of Vietnam, and other countries have asserted themselves. That's how the world is changing. It's a very dramatic change today. It's a change of, I think it's a change of attitude as much as anything.
Mm-hmm. And if I can interject for a moment, I know that throughout your career, you've been very outspoken and believe that we all have a duty to speak out against wars, and especially like the ones that we're seeing. As far as Iraq, what do you think would have been the likely results if, in Iraq, more journalists and cultural figures had spoken out against the war before it started?
The media has always been an extension of the established order. there may be a lot of myths about pre-media and constitutional rights and all that stuff. But when it comes down to it, the media is owned by big conglomerates whose politics are decidedly conservative, reactionary. So the media, I think that's important, because even these days, people are still asking the question, why doesn't the media do something? Well, they should stop asking the question and look at the media for what it is. Now, there are exceptions, as I say, to this. Some journalists have asked questions, and those who ask questions today pay a price. I can think of two. One is the great American investigative journalist, Seymour Hersh, who has difficulty publishing his work anywhere now in the United States and has to self-publish. And, of course, the second is Julian Assange. Julian Assange has spent the last 4 years in Belmarsh Prison in waiting extradition on concocted charges in the United States, basically to shut him up, to close down WikiLeaks, which did a job of journalism. Both those journalists were warning the public. They were doing a basic job of journalism. They were warning the public of what they had found out, what they had investigated and found out. So in other words, these days, it's very dangerous to go against power in the United States as it seeks to restore its position, its dominance.
John Pilger, talk about Obama, please. The, quote, pivot towards Asia that he announced and the nuclear buildup that he initiated. Does he deserve the adulation he still gets? Isn't it ironic that he won the Nobel Peace Prize?
You've almost got everything in Obama, because you've got the power of public relations. Obama was unique in that he was the first black president in the land of slavery. Right, once you've said that, that's the end of his uniqueness. Because from that point on, he's the same and probably marginally worse than any other modern president. Obama was the great warmonger. He left office having with something like 7 wars, most of them in the Middle East, on the go. He was even given the Nobel Peace Prize. And I remember in 2009, Obama stood in the center of Prague in Czechoslovakia and made a very emotional speech of make the world nuclear free. But, and just as he was speaking, his administration was planning the greatest production of nuclear warheads under any president. So if you want hypocrisy, if you want the reverse of the truth, if you want the truth behind the facade of what I would call PR, propaganda, then you go to Obama under politics. He is perfection in that, because almost everything he appeared to be, he wasn't.
Well, let's talk also about China again. I did have a question about the Belt and Road Initiative. What is the Belt and Road Initiative? What does China hope to gain by this?
The Belt and Road Initiative is basically a development plan. It's a development plan of epic proportions. It is to open up Eurasia, that vast expanse behind, if you like, quote-unquote, behind China. So all the way across to Europe from China, through hundreds of countries. One of the main reasons for it, as far as the Chinese are concerned, is not to be dependent on the oceans for its trade, for its lifelines, its lifeblood. So everything can be developed and go over land. So what we've seen already is the first freight trains from Beijing to Europe, to London, to Berlin. And developing that vast expanse has meant China offering development plans to countries that were quite underdeveloped, both in their port systems and airports and their factories, their infrastructure. So it's the development of half the world. I don't know if it is half the world, but it must be something approaching that. It's an extraordinary project, and it's forging ahead with, I mentioned, railways, high-speed railways that go for several thousand miles, you know, with trains traveling at 200 and 300 miles an hour. That's already a reality. China's building of high-speed rail networks, both for the movement of people and trade, has been the greatest spending of the greatest development of railways in its history. It's one of the many important things that we hear very little about in the West. But of course, to those who want to go to war with China, the Belt and Road is seen as China developing itself into a very powerful, aggressive country. It's not like that at all. It certainly will, the inevitable will happen. China will be the most economically powerful country. It almost is already that we've ever known. And that the Belt and Road is linking China with the great expanse of Eurasia and then all the way on to Europe itself. It's what the early travelers of the Silk Road travelers, the Marco Polos, and the explorers used to dream of. They used to call it the World Island of Eurasia. And if you look at a map of the world from the top of it, you see it's not quite as we imagine. There is this huge area between China, Russia, and Europe, and that's what's being developed now. It's the greatest development project I understand in history. It's about trade.
Well, Joe Biden was about to visit Australia. Why has your prime minister failed to vigorously demand that the U.S. release your friend, the great journalist Julian Assange, who has been in prison, as you mentioned?
And I think it's a long. I think it's a long way. Joe Biden would get jet lag. Anybody who comes, from the United States to Australia. I used to report the airport here, and I used to watch movie stars come over from the United States and fall out of the aircraft, absolutely comatose with jet lag. I'm not sure Joe would survive that trip. I've just my own view. But no, I'm being flippant. It's not the first time a presidential trip to Australia has been cancelled. Obama was coming here three or four times before he finally made it. Australia does what it's told. It's part of the U.S. empire. It doesn't need the coercion of a U.S. president visiting. This one was certainly an important one because Biden was going to announce that they'd settled all their differences and that, such as they were, and that there was now a great united front against China. It was a big anti-China trip. So we've been spared that. I mean, he was going to other places, too, on the way back. When you go to Australia, you go to the end of the world, so you can stop over a lot of places. And from here, he was going to the island state of Papua New Guinea, which the U.S. has recently bribed to allow the Pentagon to take over many of the ports and airports in that country, again to satisfy this strategic front against China. And I think he was stopping at some of the Pacific islands on the way, that all of these have, of course, U.S. bases. So it was really the emperor coming to the vast nether regions of the world down here in the end of the Pacific, giving us the favor of his presence. But alas, we're not going to see him.
John Pilger, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our allotted time. But before we have to let you go, I wanted to ask you, and before I ask you for your final thoughts, I wanted to ask you, because I thought it would be enlightening and helpful to our listeners, to ask you, what do you read regularly, and what do you read to keep yourself informed?
What do I read leisurely? I read fiction. John Grisham. I'm a great admirer of John Grisham. In fact, if you want a whole program on John Grisham, I could do one. I don't like a lot of introspective fiction, but I pushed myself away from nonfiction in the last quite a few years. So it's a good question, because I think that keeps us sane, what we're reading, actually.
John Pilger, can you give us your final thoughts, please?
My final thought, did you say?
Yes.
Sounds like I'm about to expire on your program.
No.
What? I'm sorry, I didn't. You and I have had a difficulty with what was the question? Oh, it was a final thought. Okay. I'm not sure I have many final thoughts, but I would think there was a wonderful Irish journalist called Claude Coben who once said, "Never believe anything until it's officially denied." That's a good thought. I don't know whether it's the final thought, but the thought that I would leave your listeners with is, be skeptical. Be skeptical, no matter what myths you've taken on board yourself, but just be skeptical when anybody in power tells you something. Democracies these days just simply don't work, because democracies go ahead and do things that are detrimental to the majority of their people. Otherwise they'd work. I think it is about speaking up and making your voice heard, making yourself heard in a democracy is the most crucial thing of all. There's a whole history of ideas of that in the United States. We've just got to start doing it.
With that, I want to thank you sincerely, John. It's been really terrific to have you on Law and Disorder, and you take it easy.
All right. Good to be on.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.